Good morning, this is AM, I'm Kim Landers. On the program today, the Victorian government hits back at suggestions it's dropped the ball on gang crime. The head of Queensland's Children's Court calls for more action to stop young people being locked up. And we meet the migrant lifesavers being recruited by Lifesaving Victoria.
They said it's good because, like, when we came, we didn't know how to swim, yeah? And it's good to have people around you helping you.
And how did you find the swimming training?
At the start, it was a bit hard for me because I never did it before, you know? But I practiced a few days and got better.
Anti-government protests in Iran are continuing for a fifth day, with state television saying 10 more people have been killed in clashes with police across the country. The latest fatalities bring the death toll to 12, and as the protests spread, there are fears a brutal response from authorities isn't far off. Norman Hammond reports.
In western Iran, demonstrators take on a police water cannon. Just one of the videos posted online of the biggest anti-government protests in Iran in nearly a decade. Iranian-American analyst Holly Dagrez is following events closely as curator of the Iranist newsletter. It didn't take long, she says, for legitimate economic grievances to turn political.
Suddenly, these protests kind of got out of hand. It was a controlled burn that turned into a wildfire. So all of a sudden, we've got protests in cities and towns and provinces we haven't heard from.
Much of what the world has seen has come via social media. So far, government attempts to shut down hugely popular messaging apps, such as Telegram, have been only partially successful.
Telegram has 48 million users out of its 80 million population. And these videos are pouring out. And at the same time, the Iranian government has also been slowing down the internet and cutting out mobile and internet access. And I think it's interesting that we have that access, but at the same time, these citizen journalists do remain anonymous. And there have been times when fake news has been circulated.
In public comments, President Hassan Rouhani said Iranians had the right to criticize the government, but not to turn to violence. In last year's election, he promised the economic benefits from the deal to limit Iran's nuclear program would soon flow. They haven't yet for most, says Holly Dagrez. Inflation eats away at earnings. Youth unemployment is nearly 30%.
The Rouhani government has been trying to address these economic problems, but as we saw in his speech, he really didn't give us any options of what that might be. And I think that's going to be the problem, is as until they actually address these problems, they're going to still have people in the streets.
You follow Iran, you know the country very well, you grew up in Iran. Where do you see this going?
Unfortunately, I'd like to be an optimist, but I don't think this is going really far. Protests are nothing new to the Iranian history, but at the same time, cracking down is also the norm.
Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps brutally crushed unrest in 1999 and then in 2009. Holly Dagrez isn't alone in thinking it may not be long until it swings into action again. This is Norman Hermont in Jerusalem reporting for AM.
Back home now, and the president of Queensland's Children's Court has called for action to reduce the number of unconvicted children being held behind bars. Almost 80% of children in youth detention in Queensland are on what's known as remand custody. Just under half are released immediately after sentencing. Isabella Higgins reports.
Debbie Kilroy knows what it's like to spend time behind bars.
I was a child that was put in a youth prison as 13 years of age. Going into that youth prison as a 13-year-old and then into the adult system as a 17-year-old, I came from a family that was poor, working class, struggling, and because I didn't want to go to school. And we see the same things happening, you know, four decades later.
Now she's a successful lawyer and an advocate for children and women who end up on the wrong side of the law, and runs the organisation Sisters in Inside. In Australia, there are more than 950 children behind bars each night. Of those, about 64% haven't been sentenced.
We've got to address the issue of remand, because that's the fastest growing group of children that are being locked up, criminalised and locked up.
Judge Michael Shanahan, the president of Queensland Children's Court, has called for action in his state. The percentage of unsentenced young people in prisons in Queensland is above the national average at 80%. He wants more alternative facilities so young people waiting for their court date aren't held in detention. He hopes the state government's plans to create temporary bail houses may help.
I'm very aware of the supported bail accommodation services that are being established by this government. I have been opposed to them because they're just prisons in our communities, because they're locked down 24/7, and once again we have children locked in different carceral structures.
The Royal Australasian College of Physicians also wants national reforms to remand protocols. President McCreetie says a child's stint behind bars can have lifelong implications.
You actually have a bad influence on their development into young adults, and you create an identity potentially which is more detention-based than family-based. Often these kids are dislocated from education, which puts them at risk of bad outcomes as young adults and often makes them long-term unemployed.
In 4 years, there's been a slight decrease in the number of young people sentenced to prison in Australia, but the number being held in jail on remand hasn't budged.
So the younger their children are in contact with the justice system, the more likely they are to re-offend and come back into the justice system. So you're setting up children to be recidivists when they haven't actually ever been convicted of a crime.
Debbie Kilroy hopes reforms will help others turn around their life the way she did.
It's one of the most horrific impacts that a child can experience, and it's an experience that actually can then set up to be forever institutionalised, coming in and out of the not only the youth prison system but being pipelined into the adult prison system.
Debbie Kilroy from Sisters Inside, ending that report from Isabella Higgins. More than 1,000 people died on Australia's roads last year, with the Christmas holiday period a particularly deadly time. Politicians and emergency services personnel are grappling with how to lower the toll. One MP wants international tourists to prove their driving skills before they're allowed to get behind the wheel. Here's political reporter Melissa Clark.
During the summer holidays, there's an influx of traffic to Australia's coastal holiday hotspots. It brings about a sometimes deadly combination of poor road conditions, tired drivers, and visitors from around the world.
It's a real danger that these tourists are coming across, getting into a hire car, and they really are a moving time bomb.
Sarah Henderson is the Federal MP for Corangamite, the Victorian electorate that takes in the internationally renowned scenic drive, the Great Ocean Road.
At least 20% of all crashes on the Great Ocean Road are now involving or being caused by international drivers. On a weekly basis, we are hearing of incidents involving international drivers on the wrong side of the road, stopping in the middle of the road, taking photographs of koalas.
She wants a review of international driver's licences, the system by which visitors can drive on the roads in Australia so long as they have a valid licence from their home country.
We need to look at ways in which we can ensure that we know that they have the requisite driving experience, that they are not going to be a hazard to themselves and to others.
How do you determine that?
Well, it's quite complex. As I say, I just don't think it's good enough that there's no verification of someone's driving experience when they arrive in Australia.
Options could include a compulsory safety video for all international tourists hiring cars, or asking car hire companies to impose stricter standards before renting out vehicles. The New South Wales Roads Minister, Melinda Pavey, believes automation will be the next great leap in protecting lives on the roads.
That's going to be the biggest boost to safety that we've seen in generations. Having the ability for emergency braking, for lane assist, they're really important initiatives which I think are going to have a significant impact on the road toll.
With things like the automation that you mentioned, emergency braking in particular, that's something that we see in some vehicles on the roads but not others. Do you think that should be compulsory for all new vehicles coming onto the Australian market?
I think people will move towards that technology, especially with the way that technology and the price is coming down. I think there's some real incentives. I mean, cars...
But not mandated? You don't think it should be mandatory?
At this point, I don't think there is a call for it to be mandated.
A crackdown on international drivers and new technology, they're only part of the equation. Police forces around the country emphasise that too many Australians are getting behind the wheel when they're too tired, have had too much to drink, or have taken drugs. Victoria Police Assistant Commissioner Doug Fryer says everyone needs to take responsibility.
We are out there in force, we're smashing it, we're doing what we can, but we call on everyone in community, not just those who may choose to run the gauntlet, but their friends and relatives that are seeing them having a drink or having a joint and then making a decision to get behind the wheel, to step up and say something and do something. Don't let them...
Do something. It's the one thing all involved agree upon.
Melissa Clark reporting. The Federal Health Minister Greg Hunt has committed to working with doctors and surgeons to try to tackle the problem of so-called bill shock. That's when private health insurance patients are slugged with unexpectedly high out-of-pocket expenses. Stephen Smiley reports.
It's a problem many Australians will be familiar with, so-called bill shock, when a medical appointment or procedure comes with unexpected out-of-pocket fees. But the Australian Medical Association's president, Dr. Michael Gannon, insists it's not actually that common.
86% of times people see a GP, they know the fee and they know that it's $0, they're bulk billed.
Nevertheless, the issue of bill shock prompted the Senate's Community Affairs References Committee last month to call for the government to compel doctors to publish a searchable database of their fees. The Health Minister, Greg Hunt, says he's now looking at the best way to make out-of-pocket fees information more transparent. Dr. Gannon says that's easier said than done.
If we look at the MBS for the average specialty, there could easily be 300 different items. There's between 15 and 20 different private health insurance companies, and they have a bewildering array of products.
And Dr. Gannon says even compelling doctors to publish details of the gap on their three or four most commonly performed procedures would be difficult.
If the insurers have 15 different products and there's 15 different insurers, even that small number of doctors that only use one item for a majority of their workload would have to put 200 different numbers on a website.
And that would be because different health plans would be offering different rates of coverage. And so if you were going to publish, to take that example, the three most common procedures, you'd have to go through every different plan and what it would be covered on.
That's exactly right. So we've even got the situation where insurers not only for the same operation will give doctors a different amount of money if they agree to participate in one of their no-gap schemes. That amount actually varies from state to state.
In a statement, Greg Hunt says his private health insurance reform package includes a new committee that will look into the issue. He says he's committed to helping Australians better understand the out-of-pocket costs charged by doctors.
Stephen Smiley reporting. This is AM and it's 12 minutes past 8. India proudly proclaims itself to be the world's fastest-growing major economy and has more young people entering the workforce than any other nation. But in an age of increasing automation, many worry there'll be nothing for them to do. South Asia correspondent James Bennett reports.
In a Delhi classroom, engineering student Shubhankar Singh and classmate Narendra Kandori are experimenting with a robotic hand.
This can be used in the future for bionic arms, so in the medical industry,
yes,
or the entertainment industry, or even in industrial automation techniques.
For decades, India's most widely coveted jobs have been government ones, but that's changing. And so these students are spending their holidays doing courses they hope will give them an edge in a fierce market, where thousands will compete for a single entry-level job.
Yes, it's very competitive.
Yes, it is.
The stakes for India are high. In 2022, this country is set to eclipse China as the world's most populous nation. Government figures suggest 1 million a month join the workforce. They should be what's called a demographic dividend, a boost to the country's productive capacity. But while India has ample labour supply, demand is another question. Federico Gilsander, an economist with the World Bank, says unless there are businesses willing to employ them, the young people who should power India's future could instead drain its coffers.
Exactly. It puts a huge burden on the state that has to spend resources purely on redistribution as opposed to building the human and physical capital.
The problem for India's would-be workers, however, is that the labour-intensive path to prosperity is crumbling. As these students study robotics, the World Bank is warning two-thirds of the jobs in India today are under threat from automation. Economist Federico Gilsander says that means India cannot rely on the plentiful manufacturing jobs which help propel China and other East Asian nations to prosperity.
I mean, it is a fact that manufacturing in particular, and even services, that automation and technology is a force that one needs, you know, it's a wave to be ridden, not something to be fought.
India has 800 million people, 35 or under. The Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, wants to push his country's youth out of the traditional preferred government jobs and into business.
I see 800 million potential entrepreneurs who can work towards making the world a better place.
But those who've made it themselves say the problem for India's planned shift into entrepreneurialism is the country's schools, still using old-style rote learning methods. Pavan Pognati founded the academy running this holiday robotics workshop, having tried to hire workers for startups of his own.
And while recruiting, I was able to clearly see the difference between people who are coming with this kind of practical hands-on experience of building projects in their classes. Those students were clearly standing apart, and they're able to think beyond, textbook answers. They're able to understand how to apply these concepts to build real-life projects.
Back in that lab, Shubhankar Singh is keenly aware of the irony that while learning robotics will help him shape the India of the future, it'll mean fewer jobs of the past.
I agree that the numbers will be less, but it will also create jobs for those people who are skilled enough to handle these machines and actually perform the repair functions. It's good for those who run the company, but it's bad for those who work for the company.
The next step is cultural change, like encouraging more women into work. In New Delhi, this is James Bennett reporting for AM.
Malcolm Turnbull has once again put the issue of a republic on the political agenda, suggesting a plebiscite could test public support for whether to have a directly elected head of state. At least one constitutional expert says such a move could overcome the political obstacles of the past. Lauren Williams has more.
Just when you thought you'd seen the back of the postal vote, the Prime Minister has flagged the potential for another, this time on the question of a republic. Professor Kim Rubenstein is the Director of the Centre for International and Public Law at the Australian National University. She's also a Republican and sits on the Australian Republic Movement Advisory Panel.
In contrast to the same-sex marriage debate, where the Parliament clearly had power to change the law, Parliament doesn't have that power in the context of course, a move to a republic. So how you generate the required constitutional support of a majority of people in a majority of states is a really important question.
Mr Turnbull's renewed interest in the republic vote comes after the release of the 1994-1995 Keating-era cabinet papers on Monday. They reveal the Prime Minister's office cautioned against a directly, popularly elected head of state. The parliamentary model, whereby the president is appointed and removed by a two-thirds majority of both houses of parliament, was the one that eventually went to a national referendum and was defeated in 1999. Now Malcolm Turnbull, who led the Yes campaign, says a postal survey could test the support for a republic, including support for a directly elected head of state.
I think the first thing that you would need to do is to have an honest, open discussion about how a president would be elected.
Kim Rubenstein says the plebiscite would overcome the political obstacle surrounding the model that is put to the Australian people.
That there would be the possibility of engaging in that discussion in a more productive way than what happened in 1999 if you had your plebiscite first. So if there is public support for a directly elected head of state, that would then require that the powers of that head of state be codified.
Nonetheless, Malcolm Turnbull noted that there was no appetite for change. Professor Rubenstein says the ongoing citizenship crisis has pushed the issue into prominence.
I think it's quite interesting with the synergies with the notion of a head of state, because we're so concerned about our members of parliament not holding another allegiance. In many ways, the undercurrent of what was happening with Section 44 bodes well for an appetite towards this sort of constitutional change.
Professor of International and Public Law, Kim Rubenstein, ending that report from Lauren Williams. The Victorian government has acknowledged that gangs do exist in the state, but insists the problem is being blown out of proportion. The Prime Minister yesterday accused the state government of failing to stop youth crime and gang violence. Tim Lammercraft reports.
Authorities in Victoria have previously rejected suggestions that the state has a crime gang problem. Today, Police Minister Lisa Neville took a different tack.
We have a small but significant group of young people, African young people, some of whom are born in the Sudan, some of whom have been born here in Australia, who are causing significant concern and harm in parts of Melbourne. And Victoria Police, that's why Victoria Police have put together a particular operation to focus on this group of young people, to disrupt what they're doing, and largely have been able to do that. And in recent weeks, unfortunately, we've seen some of those ringleaders decide that they're going to exert their power and basically, you know, thuggery behaviour and violence that we're seeing.
Yesterday, the Prime Minister said the situation was a, quote, failure of the Andrews government. But Ms Neville points out that some of the so-called African gangs have very different roots.
Well, Minister Society, as the police have indicated to me, was used by a gang, a white male gang, back, I think, about almost 10, 15 years ago, and it related to the public transport system. And I understand it's also a name that's used on a Foxtel show as well.
Nelly Yoa came to Australia as a Sudanese refugee in 2003. He's an athlete in training with the AFL and has ambitions to play in the league full-time. He told AM's Peter Lloyd that every fortnight he visits young Sudanese offenders in remand centres.
You know, I can confirm there are gangs out there.
Can you tell me how you define a gang?
Some of the kids that I have worked with as well as mentor, you know, they hang out in large group, you know, they commit crime. This is coming from the kids that I've spoken with.
What is the name of the gang, for example?
There's the Apex Gang and the MTS, the Menace to Society. That new emerging gang, a lot of them do call themselves that because it's a sense of belonging. A lot of them got nowhere to go. So by them calling themselves a gang, you know, it's you know, they feel as a brotherhood.
And when did Menace to Society first emerge in your consciousness? When did you first hear of it?
I'd probably say they've emerged. This is probably going back to September.
The CEO of Flemington Kensington Community Legal Centre, Anthony Kelly, has told RN politicisation of the issue is a bad idea, and he says focusing on so-called gang-related crime misses the point.
In my view, it's a classic case of how these law and order moral panics can be used politically. And I think it's actually reprehensible that federal politicians are utilising this fear of crime and very justifiable fears in certain cases, but are taking their assessments from the tabloid media rather than actual police assessments.
The CEO of Flemington Kensington Community Legal Centre, Anthony Kelly, ending Tim Lammercraft's report. For the second time in a week, a person has drowned in the surf off Victoria's Phillip Island. Authorities are again pleading with people to take care in the water. In Victoria, there's also a push to recruit lifesavers from migrant communities because over the last decade, nearly 20% of the people who've drowned in the state were born overseas. Samantha Donovan reports.
Breathe one, breathe two, back to compression.
In a life-saving club overlooking Melbourne's Port Phillip Bay, a group of young migrants is learning how to resuscitate someone.
Hold his head, nice and gentle, yeah. Remember, we don't want to cause spinal damage.
17-year-old Shuk Mohammadi arrived in Australia from Afghanistan 6 years ago. He says his family's pleased he's training to be a lifesaver.
Oh, they said it's good because, like, when we came, we didn't know how to swim, yeah? And it's good to have people around you helping you.
And how did you find the swimming training?
At the start, it was a bit hard for me because I never did it before, you know, but I practiced a few days and got better.
Blair Morton coordinates Lifesaving Victoria's multicultural projects.
There's a huge percentage of Victorians are either born overseas or have a parent that was, and we'd like our lifesaving clubs to reflect that.
And do you find the feedback you get from the youngsters is that it's helping them adapt to life in Australia?
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, it's a pretty iconic Australian sort of way of life at the beach over summer, but they build friends at the club while they're here and also other avenues to employment and schooling, and they gain some awards here as well that are quite useful and can start them on a path where they are much more involved and socially included.
The aspiring lifesavers in today's group are from the Dandenong area of Melbourne's outer southeast. Before starting this training, they've all had at least a year of swimming lessons funded by Lifesaving Victoria. Blair Morton.
They might have an ability to swim a little bit, but it's not the swimming perhaps that you and I might conceive of when we think of swimming. It's perhaps a much lower level. So they need to be able to swim 200 metres in 5 minutes before they can come to the course. So even for a fit, healthy Australian, that's still a pretty handy time for a reasonably long swim.
13-year-old Yudon Tenzin was born in India to Tibetan parents. She came to Australia 2 years ago and is one of three sisters involved in lifesaving. Her dad taught her to swim in India.
I like to swim freestyle and diving and going to the pool every Friday.
Is that where you do your swimming training?
Yeah, swimming lessons. After that, we do some freestyle and do some laps.
What have you been doing this morning in your training?
Just learning about how we help people when they're, drowning and stuff. I find it really easy sometimes, but, it's also very challenging.
Lifesaving Victoria believes its multicultural projects are also helping promote beach safety messages. Blair Morton.
Obviously, the red and yellow flags are the safest place to swim at the beach, and we're finding that that is becoming more understood and recognised, especially with the role models that we have here who can maybe translate this into their languages. But there's, like I said, there's also a softer effect where they go back into their community and someone will tell someone who tells someone. It's a bit of a trickle-down message that gets to the more grassroots part of the community and the message gets out more broadly.
Blair Morton from Lifesaving Victoria, ending Samantha Donovan's report. While enjoying a glass of wine over summer, you may not stop to consider all the factors that make your drink unique. But scientists do, and they're working on a project that could help strengthen defences against wine fraud. That's when a winemaker or region is deliberately misrepresented, and it is a problem that's affecting the Australian industry. Sarah Sedgie reports.
So this is the 2017 Pinot Gris from Tumbarumba. So we just bottling that at the moment.
At the Urban Winery Sydney, owner and winemaker Alex Retief is bottling some wine.
And there's the compressor.
With 18 years' experience as a winemaker, he has some well-evolved wine tasting skills.
I can tell varieties, I can generally guess countries broadly or hemispheres, but I'm certainly not at the stage where I can look at a wine, taste a wine and say, well, that's from, you know, the left bank of the Loire Valley and blah, 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 and be able to pinpoint down to what wine it is. And there are absolutely a lot of people who can, but that's an art form. That's amazing.
But where humans are limited, science is stepping up. The Australian Wine Research Institute and the CSIRO are collaborating on a project to help pinpoint exactly where a wine is from. Dr. Eric Wilkes is from the Australian Wine Research Institute.
What we are doing is looking at the trace metals and isotopic ratios of some elements in wine to help us identify unique characteristics of wine from different locations. And probably the difference compared to a lot of earlier projects have been used to do this for wine and for other foods is we're not just using one, but looking at a range of different ones which are linked to different aspects of where the wine comes from. So we're looking for things that are contributed by the water that grows the vines, from the underlying geology and from the air that's around them.
Dr. Wilkes says when developed, the approach could help protect Australian wine exported overseas against fraud.
Wine fraud is essentially like all forms of fraud where you are trying to misrepresent the origin or quality of a product. So in the case of wine, it can be labelling a product as something it is not, i.e. something like a very well-known or famous brand, or probably more commonly labelling something as being a variety or from a region that it's not originally from.
It's a problem the industry has been responding to. Brian Smedley is the chief executive of the South Australian Wine Industry Association.
Obviously, when you have a wine that's in market that's have a strong brand that's reputed to be an Australian brand, companies want to take and respond in ways to ensure that that brand's reputation is preserved.
And with swindlers using more advanced methods to dupe people, Dr. Wilkes says better scientific defences can help.
These days, people who are faking well-known wines are using much, much, much more sophisticated techniques, and they can be very, very difficult to find.
But if you're more of a wine enthusiast than a serious connoisseur, winemaker Alex Retief has this advice.
To me, wine is kind of like a painting. Everyone's got different opinions on artworks and everyone sees something differently. And same with wine. And the only thing that I really will keep stressing to everyone who comes in here, if you like it, it's not a bad wine. Doesn't matter what price point it is. If you like it, that's the wine for you.
Winemaker and owner of the Urban Winery Sydney, Alex Retief, ending Sarah Sedgie's report. To finance now, Wall Street is closed, oil is $60.10 US a barrel, and the Australian dollar is buying 78 US cents. It's also buying 65 euro cents. That is AM for today. I'm Kim Landers. It's 8:30.